This week in Retronauts, it's a real Dragon Quest. Hi everyone, welcome to episode 395 of Retronauts. I'm Jeremy Parrish, echoing loudly in your ears. And this episode is brought to you by a patron. Patron Andrew Duff has requested a few things, and finally the one we were able to realistically handle with our knowledge and so forth is a follow-up to the Breath of Fire episode, which was 380. And this is Breath of Fire 3 and 4, the PlayStation duo. And, apparently Breath of Fire is kind of popular with our listeners. The first Breath of Fire episode got great engagement. That is how you measure everything these days. That is the metric. And when I requested people write in with opinions for this episode and the following episode, we'll be recording Wario Land 4 in advance, or 4 and Shake It, we got a ton of letters for these two games, not so many for Wario. So that's probably why we don't see any more Wario games, but it doesn't explain why we don't see any more Breath of Fire games. But we're not here to speculate about that, especially since we have a special guest this episode who is forbidden from such speculation in public. Please introduce yourself, not the voice of fandom, not speaking for Capcom.
Right. So this is Patrick Kulikowski, and yes, I actually do work for Capcom USA, but I am primarily here as a Breath of Fire fanboy and not so much as a Capcom rep. So
let's not say primarily. Let's say entirely.
Entirely.
As a Breath of Fire fan. <better. laughs> Just, I don't want to get you in trouble. No. Nothing that Patrick says on this episode indicates in any way an opinion held or plans maintained by Capcom USA, Capcom of Europe, or Capcom Japan. No one at Capcom knows anything about Breath of Fire except Patrick. That's
well, I don't want to say that, but that's, but okay. For the purposes of this episode,
did I take it too
sure.
far?
maybe.
Oh, okay, but anyway, yes, Patrick, you've been a huge cheerleader for the series for as long as I have known you on the internet, and it just seemed appropriate to bring you in for this, and I'm grateful that Capcom was like, yes, please go talk about this franchise that sometimes people get angry up about. It's fine. That was actually pretty cool of them. A lot of companies, a lot of publishers would not be okay with that at all. So I am grateful to Capcom, and so grateful, in fact, I won't make any negative comments about Breath of Fire 6. Also, who do we have this episode calling in from Canada?
I am Nadia Oxford, the second half of the Axe of the Blood God RPG podcast, and I can say what I damn well please.
You can. You don't represent anyone except Nadia Oxford and the Axe of the Blood God podcast.
I represent me, myself, and I, and Kat. We are a unit.
Are you? Okay, so what you say here can be held against Kat.
Absolutely, everything. Everything I say, like to the barista down the street, that can be held against Kat, too.
there's some real, I'm sure some real blackmail material happening in that coffee shop. Anyway, so thanks to Andrew Duff for requesting this topic, and thanks to Capcom for being like, yeah, it's cool, and thanks to everyone who wrote in for this topic. So with that said, we are going to jump right in and talk about Breath of Fire 3. If you would like to catch up with this episode, like I said, episode 380 of Retronauts, published a couple of months ago, was on Breath of Fire 1 and 2, and we covered those games pretty thoroughly, although I believe Patrick has some things he might want to throw in or correct along the way, being the exceptional Breath of Fire fan that he is.
I mean, It's hard to talk about the first two in just like a one and a half hour podcast or whatever. So there are things that I felt like could have been included, but it's like then you'd be talking all day, so it's fine.
Yes, and we are on a strict schedule. We are not like our parents get very upset if we if we're down in the basement too long.
That's fine.
Yeah. So anyway, I will ask actually. Nadia, were you on the first Breath of Fire episode? I can't remember.
Yes, I was.
Okay, I thought so. So you've talked about your experiences with Breath of Fire, but Patrick has not. Patrick, how did you become a fan of Breath of Fire, such a huge fan that you were like, I'm going to go get a job at Capcom.
Oh, well, so Breath of Fire 1 was my first RPG that I received as a kid. It was a Christmas 95 gift from my dad. Very random gift. So little did my dad know, he set off this crazy fandom within me. But being my first RPG, it really like inspired me. I wasn't used to that sort of game. I went into it thinking it was going to be like a Zelda clone or something like that, and it was completely different. I found myself in a random encounter battle, had no idea what I was doing, had to read the manual to understand how turn-based combat actually worked, and from there, like, the rest is history, I think. But the following year, I got Breath of Fire 2 as a birthday gift, and that one shot my, like, passion for the series, like, way up because of all the upgrades to like the plot, the characters, and whatnot. So,
but it did terrible things to your understanding of the English language.
I mean, I felt that despite the translation, Breath of Fire 2's plot was very much understandable all the way through. I never felt super confused by what was going on. Granted, yeah, some of the nuance could have used some work, but I never felt lost playing that game or anything.
I actually wrote a thing on US Gamer about how I was replaying the game quite recently, and I realized, yeah, despite its really awful translation, it really does have an interesting take on the whole kill God thing. I mean, I think you, like me, that was probably your first experience killing God in a JRPG.
Yeah, for sure. And I think also for that time, like, it came out in 94 in Japan and 95 here in the States. And I feel like you didn't really have that sort of kill God thing in RPGs
at the time. No, absolutely not.
Maybe, of course, Japan had Shin Megami Tensei beforehand.
And Final Fantasy Legend.
That's true.
I never
you
played
can chainsaw that. God in the face.
Oh, God is a little Amish man in a hat, as that one comedian said.
That's pretty rad. I mean, Ryu slashes God in the face at the end of 2, which I thought was pretty incredible.
Yeah, and you see blood.
And you see blood. Rated kids to adults, by the way.
because that was the reason I think that we finally got Breath of Fire 2, is like after the implementation of the rating systems, it was Nintendo's just like, okay, put whatever you want on our systems. We don't care anymore. It's out of our hands. So
right, I figure
like,
it was,
oh boy.
I figure it was more lax at that point.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, Breath of Fire 2 shot my passion for it way up. And then lo and behold, I come across an EGM issue that comes with an E3 1997 supplement. And it has this tiny, tiny screenshot of Breath of Fire 3, which was my first exposure or learning that a third game was being made, and my heart froze, and then it sank to see that it was only coming to PlayStation. My thoughts as a Nintendo kid were, how am I, a new N64 owner, going to convince my parents to get me a PS1?
Yes, yeah, same.
And funny enough, it didn't happen for me until like 1999, but BOF3 ended up being my second game right after Final Fantasy VII, and in the lead up to all of that, I would just pour over all the magazines that covered Breath of Fire 3, like Tips and Tricks, Game Pro, any sort of info. I even bought the Prima strategy guide and read through the entire thing because I was so hyped for this game and spoiled myself in the process.
I was going to say, that's quite a story to spoil yourself on, because it really takes a twist in the second half.
It really does. Yeah. But, whatever. I was a kid. I was silly, and I was just super amped about this game. So,
yeah. And how about you, Nadia, with Breath of Fire 3? Did you play it when it was brand new, or did you come around to it later?
I came around a little later. I did get my PlayStation a little bit after my N64, so I had to wait. But you do not remember this, I'm sure. But I wrote a story about Breath of Fire 3, how I came across it for Toasty Frog Zine, and.
I just dug those up the other day, actually. They're on my bookshelf at work now. All five issues. Yeah. I'll have to flip through that and find it.
You'll have to find it, because basically Breath of Fire 3, as I said, was kind of my, on this article I said, was my entry into adulthood, and not in the greatest way possible. I had a really terrible job in a kennel that sold dogs for a massive, massive profit. And we're talking about like really badly bred dogs, like for example, the Taco Bell Chihuahua was the hottest thing. So we had so many like just awful, really sick animals that we'd sell off, and it was a really depressing job. It was really awful. I'd deal with dead animals all the time, and when I tried to kind of tell my parents, "Hey, this is really kind of ruining me. This is a terrible job. They're like, well, you have to stick to it because you're an adult now. I had just turned 18. And so that was their logic. So I eventually ended up buying Breath of Fire 3 because at least, hey, I'm making this money. I'm miserable. I may as well, you know, be miserable with a game. And yeah, I really just adored the game, not just because of the circumstances I was in, but also just because still some of my favorite sprite work ever done. Has a, not the greatest story, but a really interesting story, I think, really different. Like I said, it takes a twist in the second half. Has a really, a soundtrack that really grew on me. It took time, but it really did, like, I really love it now. And the isometric view, something about it just, I think it just really makes me feel warm and happy. So it's not a perfect RPG. It has a lot of problems, like random encounters being kind of out of control. But overall, I really, really loved the world presented.
Yeah, Breath of Fire 3 was one of the kind of the first post-Final Fantasy VII wave of RPGs to reach the US. And, you know, these days we take role-playing game localizations from Japan for granted because so many of them happen. It's hard to keep up. But, you know, the 90s, that was not really the case. And Breath of Fire was one of the few series that actually made it over pretty consistently. But it just seems like after Final Fantasy VII came out and, you know, once the writing on was on the wall that it was going to be a huge, huge game, we really saw a ton of RPGs localized in 1998. And I think a lot of people got into them expecting, hey, it's going to be like Final Fantasy VII. It's going to be like bleeding edge technology and movies and 3D and like cyberpunk. And it really wasn't. Most of these games were not like that at all. And so I don't know. I think I was kind of guilty of that. As much as I enjoyed the games before Fantasy VII, I just felt like, wow, this you know, Final Fantasy VII really pushed some boundaries and really wanted to take the RPG in a different place than swords and sorcery. And so anytime I went back, you know, to the subsequent RPGs that would come out that didn't really go as far as Final Fantasy VII, which was most of them, I just felt like, I don't know. This is a little disappointing. And this was one of those. I feel like if I were to replay it now, which I really ought to do at some point, I would really enjoy it a lot more than I did at the time. But at the time, you know, I wanted something that was a bit more daring, either technologically or narratively. And so, you know, I was one of the few people who was like, oh, Saga Frontier, this game is weird. I like that. And now everyone's come around to it. Now people are like, right. Oh, yeah, Saga Frontier is cool. I like this game. But that wasn't the case in 1998. Whereas this one, I played all the way through, but it really kind of felt like I was forcing myself. And I just kept waiting for something to happen, and it didn't. But, you know, so it goes. It's fine. That's really on me and not on the game. I think it is a very solid RPG that just happened to kind of not be what I wanted it to be at the time. But in hindsight, like there's a lot I like about it, and it really does feel like it just is cut from that pure, wonderful Capcom mold, you know, that cloth they were using in the late 90s, you know, the great sprite work like you saw in their CPS2 and CPS3 games, and a kind of inventive, semi-fantasy, semi-futuristic, semi-old-fashioned world with a kind of a lot of world building behind the scenes that isn't necessarily right there up front. And at the same time, you know, also very traditional in a lot of ways. You know, it has still turn-based combat and it's a fixed viewpoint. It's not like Final Fantasy VII where the camera's like, whoa, zoom in around, look at your characters right from all sides. It's like, no, it's Breath of Fire. So you're looking at your characters facing off in a line against the bad guys from kind of a three-quarters perspective, sort of behind and to the side of them. That's just how it is. And that's like, it kind of knows what it is. And it says, let's take what this is. And instead of being something different, let's just be this game and do it the best that we can. And, you know, Breath of Fire 4 takes that even further with even more impressive visuals and a much more intricate story and world building. And so, I really see these two games as being part of a whole. And I feel like, you know, it is a good time for me to reevaluate them and give them more of a fair shake than I did back in the day.
Yeah. I think you being a Mega Man Legends fan, you can probably agree that the game like came out around the same time as Legends, and it really kind of shows. Like, both games, I always felt like shared an identity in a way.
Well, I mean, we can talk about the talent here, but there was a lot of Mega Man and Mega Man Legends talent drawn into the Breath of Fire games from, that's Capcom Division 3, I think. Mm-hmm. And the director of this game was Makoto Ikehara, who had directed, designed, I guess it was the title, Breath of Fire 1 and 2 and Mega Man Legends. He was one of the key creative personnel behind Mega Man Legends. And then would go on to make Breath of Fire 4 and Dragon Quarter. It's all part of a continuum, basically.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah. I will say Breath of Fire 3 is the type of game that you need to set aside a lot of time to. And it's not something you can just try to blow through and just quickly get it over with.
Nope, it's a slow burn.
Yeah, it's very much a slow burn, and it does demand your time. I think I clocked in by the end of the game like 60-ish hours, probably.
That was about my take too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I didn't dig around and do a lot of side quests and stuff. I don't know if there are that many side quests to do, but I pretty much took a direct path through the game. I didn't do super critical path, but at the same time I also didn't say, well, I'm gonna soak in this a little longer and go grind for levels and master all the skills and things like that. I was just like, yeah, I've got other RPGs to play, so I'm just gonna play through this one, see what the story goes to, and call it a day. And that was about 60 hours, so a pretty big game.
3 admittedly has a lot of padding, like that seaside town. I can't remember the name of it, but I want to die every time I go to it because you're stuck there for Rapala. You're back and forth that stupid town so freaking much. Like, half the game takes place in that damn town.
So there is an interesting Shmupulations recently translated an interview from 97 from a Japanese magazine with the developers of Breath of Fire 3, and there are some interesting nuggets they say in there in regard to how they like draft out the game's plot and whatnot. But basically they have like a rough outline where they would connect some interesting dialogue from the NPC town NPCs up with that larger story idea, but then they felt that if they overworked the story too much in the beginning, it would end up constraining their creativity. So as a writer, Ikehara said that he didn't try to dictate exactly what they should do, and that it was more important to them that the overall game is fun, and that sometimes like they might just think of a cool map or story idea that might not tie into the overarching plot, but they would still add it in
for kicks
in a way. Yeah. So it was the more I read through those interviews, the more I was like, okay, they go with a sort of orthodox RPG mindset, but then they also don't want to like always dictate what the team should do. And if anyone has like a creative idea that may not tie to, you know, Ryu's quest for self-discovery or anything, but if they think it works and it's fun, then they just put it in. Whether you call that shoehorning or not, I mean, that's up to everyone else to decide. But yeah.
I wouldn't say shoehorning so much as just not being, I would say, overly aggressive with editing. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of this kind of collaborative process is throwing a lot of ideas out there and then saying, all right, this is great, but this seems like it's, you know, kind of off in the weeds. Do we really need this? Maybe we should prune this. It sounds like they didn't do so much of that. It was just like, hey, if you've got an idea, like a scenario for these folks, let's do it. Let's see what happens. So, you know, that's fine.
Yeah, it's an interesting approach for sure.
Yeah. That's one way to put it. So let's see. Other key personnel, Yoshinori Takenaka, who worked on as a producer, Pocket Fighter, Mega Man X4, Mega Man 8, Super Puzzle Fighter 2 Turbo, Hironobu Takeshita, who worked on Breath of Fire 4, Dragon Quarter, Mega Man 9, Zack and Wiki. So right there, you kind of see, like, just look at those games and compare them to Breath of Fire 3, and you really see where this comes from. The lead artist was Toru Yamashita, who had been an artist on Mega Man Legends, but also Resident Evil 0, and Kirby's Air Ride, of all things.
Kirby's Air Ride, eh?
That was on Moby Games. I was like, huh, okay.
Wow.
Wacky. Cute.
Why not?
I mean, yeah, like Kirby, Pecco, are they really that different?
Exactly. Yeah, they're both kind of squishy.
They have similar feet, sort of.
They're round. They're sort of cute. Weirdly destructive.
Yeah.
Have, you know, connections to godlike beings. I think it works.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that.
Let's see. Character designer Tatsuya Yoshikawa had done work on a bunch of Mega Man X games.
Oh, boy, yeah.
Yeah, Mega Man 7. Wow, yeah. And went on to do, you know, more Mega Man games, further Breath of Fire games, Zack and Wiki again, Gravity Rush 2, and Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom. And then the composers... Oh, go ahead, Patrick.
No, I was just going to say, the most recent thing Yoshikawa did, he left Capcom eventually, but worked as freelance. He helped design the Devil May Cry 5 characters.
Oh, okay. Really?
Yeah.
All right. And composers, there were two composers, Yoshino Aoki, who had worked on Mega Man Battle and Chase, Mega Man, then would go on to work on Mega Man Battle Networks 2, 3, 5, and 6, and more recently, Final Fantasy 15. Mm-hmm. And Akari Kaida, who had worked on Street Fighter Alpha, Night Warriors, Cyberbots, Resident Evil, Mega Man and Bass, a lot of these kind of like Capcom arcade games. So I feel like working in an RPG was pretty different. They did eventually work on Mega Man Battle Network, so you got a little into the and Okami. So you get a little of that RPG adventure eventually, but this was kind of stepping out. And it is a really unique soundtrack. It really is.
Yep, so good.
Like when people were complaining about the Marvel vs. Capcom 2 soundtrack and how it went into jazz, I was like, yeah. But the Capcom already did that with Breath of Fire 3. So what's the problem here?
And not just jazz, a lot of that. I almost feel like there's a lot of Pet Shop Boys in there, too, just being a Pet Shop Boys fan. I hear it in the Guild music, the Machine Town music. It's very, very Pet Shop Boyish to me, which is great.
Huh.
It's very, I think Kaida referred to it as like jazzy pop, in a way.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a hybrid of jazz and pop. But I loved how 3 was very much a huge break from the typical orchestral sound, not just of Breath of Fire 1 and 2, but just JRPGs in general. And then even Breath of Fire 2 had like Mega Man X styled battle themes and whatnot, but mm-hmm. this was just full on like pop, vibrant, jazzy stuff. And Kaida was very adamant about giving the game that sort of soundtrack due to its colorful visuals, and she just simply wanted to break away from the classical conventions of JRPG music, and I thought it worked out wonderfully for this game. I think it fits the overall vibe of it.
It distressed me at first. I was not a fan because I was a really big fan of Breath of Fire 2's rocking music, and then to hear like the jazz. It did take a while for the soundtrack to grow on me, but it really did in the end. Even though the Green Forest soundtrack is really kind of a direct lift of Chrono Trigger.
Yeah, it's the one. The one I was going to say that was the one connection to an existing JRPG. That was pretty much taken straight out. But then, you know, Chrono Trigger did get its fusion jazz, acid jazz, arrange album, Brink of Time. So it's all on a continuum here.
And, I mean, let's face it, Chrono Trigger took the wall and turned it into a game soundtrack.
That's true.
I think Kaida knows Mitsuda, the composer of Chrono Trigger. So there is that connection.
I'm sure. Yeah, it's a small world over there.
Absolutely.
In that industry. Okay, so anyway, that's kind of the background behind Breath of Fire 3. Now we should talk about the game. We talked a little bit about the visuals, but first let's talk about how this game is connected or isn't connected to the first two games. Because there did seem to be like a pretty direct continuity between 1 and 2, whereas this game feels like it has a very different world. Like it takes place in a completely separate world from Breath of Fire 1 and 2, and yet it also seems to have some pretty meaningful connections to the first two games.
Absolutely.
It definitely has some really not nearly as strong as 1 and 2, which blatantly says, like, the character are descendants from the first game. But one thing that's really interesting about Breath of Fire 1, 2, and 3 is if you talk to the Windians, the winged people, you'll find that over time they lose their ability to fly. Like, from Breath of Fire 1 to 2, it was because they kind of intermarried. Ryu married Nina, so that diluted the bloodline. And then in 3, they lose their wings entirely, except for Nina, who has, like, kind of these wings on her back that don't really work. Mm. And the thing that's interesting about that is they mention that they're not afraid of heights. It's just an innate thing that they have. So they say, like, well, maybe it's because our ancestors used to have wings. So, yeah, there is definitely that connection there, but it's a lot more subtle than it was between the first two games.
I will say, though, the game starts up before you even see the title screen. You see a scrolling mural of the Breath of Fire 1 characters fighting
right.
the goddess Myria, who was originally localized as Tyr in the first game.
For some reason.
Yeah, and so it does actually hit you over the head with, like, from the get-go of, hey, there's a connection to Breath of Fire 1 with this game. Two, I think there's less of a connection to two. There's some, like, cameos here and there from those characters, but later on, as you progress through the story and you get to Dragneer, the Dragon Clan's hometown, or the Brood, as they're called.
The Brood,
here,
yeah.
You actually get to see the mural you saw in the beginning, opening scene of the game, and it kind of connects a bit more. I almost feel, though, like it's less about them talking about the Breath of Fire 1 characters and more just about Myria, because she does, spoilers, turn out to be the big bad of this game. So,
yeah, the Breath of Fire 3, when you think about it, though, maybe we'll get into this in more detail, but it's really more of a game that tells a bunch of small stories versus one big story. It's almost like To Kill a Mockingbird in that way, where it's several little stories that lead up to a climax. I mean, the first lesson you learn is don't F with the mafia. That's your first story arc.
So true. Yeah. Especially if they're horse bros. Yeah.
If they're horse bros, you are in trouble. Don't mess with them, man. Oh, that's so sad, though, when you think about it. I really actually like Ray. I think he's a great character. He's a very, very bad influence, but he tries to be a good dad to these orphans that he adopted.
Yeah.
And again, that involves him effing with the mafia and really pissing everyone off because... But they thought they were doing something good because they're still kids. They're naive. They don't really know how the world works. But no, they realize, well, you can't just rob from the rich and give to the poor, unfortunately, because someone richer is going to get really angry about it and probably mess you up.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so this is probably a good point to mention the fact that the game begins with Ryu as a kid, as a tyke. A little,
very cute.
A little sprout. He's a wee lad. So you actually spend a lot of the game with Ryu in his sort of juvenile form, and Nina also is a little kid, and Rei is the thief that they meet is a teenager, and so you had kind of the Zelda Ocarina of Time thing going on half a year before Ocarina of Time showed up in the US. So take that, Nintendo.
I have to say it's the way the game starts off too is really unique in that Ryu as a kid is still in his dragon form, a whelp, like a baby dragon, and he's encased in crystal, a chrism as it's called in the universe, and a couple of miners basically blow that up to try to get him out of it, and that wakes him up, and he ends up going on a killing spree essentially.
Yeah.
And you as the player end up torching a number of the miners within the cave before getting knocked out and shipped off on like a railroad or whatever. I guess what's funny about that is it doesn't take very long to get to the Breath of Fire of the game, because literally the first battle you're torching two miners. One who, funny enough, looks like Mogu, and the other from one, and another one that looks sort of like Bo from the first game. So.
Yeah.
Harsh. Yeah, the opening here... The way it sort of unfolds reminds me a little bit of Dragon Quest V.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you start out as the main character as a kid. I mean, obviously, that's a much more tragic story than this is, you know, from a personal standpoint. Like here, Ryu never knows his dad. There you have to, like, watch your dad get murdered and then be sold into slavery until you're a teen. That's harsh.
Yeah.
Here, you know, you have a lot of adventures as a kid, as a whelp dragon, with teenage Ray and your other childhood companion, Tipo, And as you guys said, you know, you kind of fall in with a rough crowd, the horsemen, Balio and Sunder. Yeah. And, you know, eventually you do kind of work your way free from their influence when you meet a gargoyle dude named Gar who like literally just murders them for you in a coliseum that they try to force you to fight into. But then Gar tries to murder you too. He's like, oh, dragon, gotta kill it. And that kind of activates the time skip where Ryu escapes again and disappears and then turn the hands of time forward and everyone's older.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I always like those little time skips. But I will say that I feel like I totally get where you're coming from with Dragon Quest V being like one of the most tragic games ever. I totally agree. I feel like Breath of Fire 3 does touch that a bit, though, because, again, the Mafia, like, even though you beat them eventually, like, they scatter you to the winds. They burn your house down. Ray, spoilers here, Ray thinks you're dead. He thinks Tipo and you died because of his, like, neglect. So he kind of becomes a recluse and becomes, he learns how to use his were-tiger form and uses it to hunt down people of Sin City where the Mafia is stationed. When you do
he kind of turns into Cody from Street Fighter Alpha.
He turned exactly into Cody from Street Fighter Alpha. And when you do join up with him again, he's just never the same. Like he's clearly been like kind of scarred and traumatized. And that's really a shame because before he's such like a kind of a fun, sunny character. And just, he's become so angry and sad that, you realize, okay, Ryu's fine, but Tipo, when you find out what happens to him, that's even sadder. But he's just never the same character ever again. But man, that were-tiger form is amazing, and it has such a cool mechanic where
if you can control it,
but you can learn how.
Yeah,
it's so amazing.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. I will say the first time the game kind of throws the player for like an emotional loop is the first big mission that Ryu, Tipo, and Ray are tasked with by Bunyan is to murder a new, this chimeric-like creature that's terrorizing the locals of the McNeil village. And when you finally go to do the deed, you kill it, and it dies standing on its 2 feet, blocking like a cave behind it. And the player doesn't even have to investigate this part. They can leave the cave and be on their merry way, but if they do go into the cave that it was protecting, you find out there were dead cubs of the new that it was trying to protect. So it's like this like gut-wrenching like slap in the face of like, oh, this thing was merely just trying to protect its cubs that it didn't even realize were dead already, trying to like care for them and feed them, and here you are slaying it or whatever. It's
and yet you have a real choice because it's hunting all the animals, it's killing all the crops and everything like that to provide for these dead animals. And
right.
I think basically the money quote from Ray is what sums up everything in these situations, where it's like, man, don't that beat all?
Yeah, doesn't this just
what else
beat
can
all?
You say? It's like, so it goes.
Yeah. So there are these interesting moments of like moral ambiguity within the story. Of like, are the people I'm controlling doing the right thing? And that also ties into the end of the game too. With the final boss.
Yeah, so. I was gonna say, like, after the time skip, I think things become even more sort of murky and nebulous. You know, as you explore the world and you kind of build your party, you have Momo, the academic nerd mole girl, who has a little robot named Honey.
She's cute.
There's Gar, who eventually joins up with you, even though he tried to kill you earlier. There's Pekko, the little onion dude, who is, you know, like mutant Kirby or whatever. there's a few other characters, but really, like, as you explore the world, you learn more about kind of its history. And this is where kind of Breath of Fire 3 diverges a lot from the first two games, in that there's a lot of history to this world, and there are a lot of, you know, kind of advanced ruins that you really didn't see in the first two games, cities and ports and things like that. More advanced technology. I think there's like a big tower, if I remember right. It's been a while since I played.
Angel Tower.
Yeah. And
yeah, that's right.
Like, you know, there was this level of technology that exists in this world and has existed that you just didn't see in Breath of Fire 1 and 2. And, you know, a big part of the technology was directed toward, if I recall right, preventing the desert on one of the continents from expanding. And eventually, you know, the desert got out of control. And so basically there's an entire continent that's more or less unlivable. Mm-hmm. And it's because of sort of the events that the Dragon Clan were involved in. And, you know, going on to spoil the entire story, like when you fight the final boss isn't even evil. The final boss is like, I'm trying to do what's best for the world. And when dragons are around, it ruins everything. So I'm going to destroy you, or you can, you know, just agree to stay here and not be part of the world and not make the world worse. Like, you have your choice, but I can't let you go. And so, you know, you can either actually do the dragon quest one thing and choose to just basically live there and die. And that's the downer ending. Or you can fight the goddess, and who knows what that causes, what happens there. But right. At the same time, you know, there is another presence in the world, the Yggdrasil.
Right.
Okay. The world tree, and it's sentient. You talk to it sometimes, you know, it can be one of your training masters, and it does speak to Myria when you're in the final battle and says, like, hey, you're a goddess, but you're overstepping your bounds. And, you know, you have to let the mortals figure things out on their own. You need to basically de-escalate, and she won't.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not like she wants to conquer the world. It's pretty much the opposite. But at the same time, you know, there's the question of, like, is she overstepping her bounds? Is it wrong for Ryu to be free and to live his life when it can potentially be the source of calamity? So, yeah, there aren't any clear answers in this game. And that is something, looking back, I really respect about it. At the time, it felt kind of underwhelming.
Felt like a cop-out to me at first, but yeah.
Now I see, like, that's actually much more of a narrative tradition in Japan. Not to give you clear endings, not to say, oh, you feel good because you won, but to say, like, well, you know, a victory, but at what cost?
Yeah. Right.
It is interesting how Myria in the first game is just portrayed as this goddess of destruction. That will just be used for the purpose of destroying the opposition or whatnot. But in this one, she's like the overcaring mother who doesn't want anything bad to befall humanity and will do whatever it takes, whether that's conjuring up a desert to and making, like, in the industrialized area of the world, like, obsolete, and then of course employing guardians to basically commit genocide against the Dragon Clan and whatnot.
Yeah.
It's a lot of deep stuff, and I do like that there is some ambiguity to it, like, are Ryu and Co. really doing the right thing? But the way I see it is, in my view, I've always felt like Myria, yeah, she's overstepping her bounds. She's taking things too far. Let people figure things out for themselves.
And I mean, even her best intentions aren't going to work out in the end because, number one, frankly, one of my favorite parts in the game is in Cliff when you fight Gaara's friend. And that's when you first kind of realize what the Guardians were about and how they feel about what they were told to do, which is, again, slaughtering all the dragons, committing genocide.
Right.
You actually at one point find a number with Gaara's name beside it. And that he's like, that's how many dragons I killed. And it's just
an angel tower. That was super chill. And that's when Gaara finally turns on the child Ryu and you fight him right before the time skip.
Myria is interesting when you, the first game, she was very evil, no real question about it. Second game, I think Death FN is her offspring, so same thing going on there. But three, it's like she's like, I want to protect humans, I want them to, like, stay as they are, but that's not going to do anything because one of the reasons I find Breath of Fire 3's world so fascinating is because as you get deeper into the game, you find these towns that are, you have this technology washing up on their shores and they're using it and they're building things out of it. And I don't think she likes that, but they're still doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you can't stop civilization's progress in those
basically
regards.
For better, for worse.
Yeah. For better, for worse. Yeah.
All All right, so that's plenty of discussion about the story. I would like to talk about some of the game mechanics, because, you know, it is very much a descendant of Breath of Fire 1 and 2, but it adds a lot of new stuff, or, you know, it builds on the things that had come before. So, actually, let's talk about the fishing minigame first,
because yes.
Breath of Fire always, you know, from the very beginning, you had the field actions and could catch fish and so forth, but... People often point to Breath of Fire 3's fishing and say, like, this is it. This is the peak of fishing minigames in RPGs. Like, every RPG that has had a minigame where you fish, which is a whole lot of RPGs, has just been grasping at this one and falling short.
The only one that even comes close to touching it for me is Stardew Valley's. I sat there and I caught every damn fish in the game, including the whale. I think that's, like, the white whale, if you excuse the expression. And what's really cool about the fishing game, too, is that it's so useful because the stuff you catch is worth a lot of money if you don't want it. Some of it actually does, like, powerful in-game actions. And you can trade it to, I can't remember the name of the trader, but he can give you some super powerful weapons and armor if you have the patience to sit there and fish for whales like an idiot like I did. And I had the patience. I love that mission.
Isn't the merchant like a goby kind of fish dude?
He's a goby.
Manilos, yeah.
Manila.
Manila race, yeah.
And you catch him by like using coin as a bait. So
yeah.
And it's so perfect.
It's such a glow up. The fishing system's such a glow up in 3 from 1 and 2.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like 1 was just you press a button and you either catch it or you don't. 2 was a little more nuanced in that. Like a side view, and you're reeling the lure in and whatnot. But 3 just takes it to a whole nother level where you basically, once you cast your line and you can basically time your movement of the lure to create like tech bonuses, which will attract the fish to bite and will even attract ones that your flimsy early game rod can't reach just yet. And when the fish bites, it goes into this like fighting meter battle where you have to keep this meter on a fish icon at all times to make sure it doesn't slip away. And it's just like a very intense fight of like moving that cursor like left to right, making sure you're enveloping the fish in this green meter.
The dinging sound is still a stressor for me. Dinging sound that you get when you overstress things.
Yeah. There's that ding that occurs, and then you have this amazingly deep voiced fishing narrator.
Yes. this game adds in a bunch of Sega CD style, like lunar style voice clips in combat, but the best voice clip is "Get ready,
get ready,
yeah, get ready." Or
is a question? It's a question. Like, okay, you want to fish or not?
Right. I think my favorite from the narrator was after you catch something, he's like, "Very good,
very good,
great."
Yeah, there's a kind of like Sega, you know, Sega Bass Fishing or Sega Virtua Fishing kind of vibe to it. It's very good.
Yeah,
I respect it deeply. I respect the way Japan really puts care into their fishing minigames. I think that's very important.
For sure. Yeah, some would argue it's still one of the best. The only other fishing game I put a little bit of time to was Final Fantasy 15.
Mm-hmm. That
I think
was good.
It did pretty good. I thought it was almost on par with what the OF3 offered for me. But one funny connection there is like you have the composer Yoshino Aoki who worked on 3 and 4's soundtrack. She also did the fishing music to Final Fantasy 15, which I thought was
perfect.
A really interesting cross section there.
If nothing else, the thing I love the most about Final Fantasy 15's fishing is the way that Noctis just whips out the rod the same way he would the sword, just totally abusing his power. It's good, right. Good for you.
Yeah.
So it's like I said, it's been a while since I've played, but I'm thinking if I'm correct, am I remembering right that this game does away with the world map skills? Field actions?
Well, there are field actions. Like Ryu can slice on the field. You can actually mug people in this game. you can literally slash at NPCs, okay. And a little Zenny coin will pop out, and they won't react to it, of course, or anything. But so there are field actions. Like Rei can pick locks, and Nina can shoot like magic out of her wand to activate like a puzzle. Echo headbutts trees, that sort of thing.
Right, but they're more integrated into the actual design of the dungeons and so forth, as opposed to you know, in Breath of Fire 1 especially, where it was just like, hey, you want to catch some meat? Let's go hunting.
Right.
I do miss the hunting.
So it feels like there's scaled down a bit.
Yeah.
But you have some other changes that are, you know, pretty significant. You have the camping element, but you also have just a lack of random battles, which, thank God.
On the world map, yeah. I think 3's world map is like one of the best JRPG world maps you can have. Where there's no random encounters. You're this little chibi Ryu moving around this the screen. And if you want to get into fights to like grind Zenny or experience, every so often you take a few steps, an exclamation point will appear over Ryu's head, and you can choose to then enter like a generic battlefield to fight, roam around, fight monsters. You might even find like a randomly generated item or two.
It's like kind of it's the kind of battle system I appreciate most, where you fight on your own terms. And as you said, it gives you that little bit of a bonus by finding items that maybe sometimes even weapons and armor that will, you know, just give you, make you feel good for finding it. And you have to search to find it sometimes. And that's when you run into more enemies, but that's how you level up. It's a nice feedback loop.
It is, yeah. And then the camping thing is neat in that you can talk to your party members there, get their feedback on like the current plot beat. That's going on, but they can also point you into the right direction. So if you haven't played the game in a while or whatever, you can just go camping and talk to them and figure out what you need to do next, which
I like how camping actually works like an inn, but it's not perfect.
Yeah,
if you want to fully heal, you have to pay money, but if you need to like restore your hit points and most of your magic points, you can camp, but you still, certain status elements won't be cured, certain like things that lower your hit points permanently until you go to an inn, like that'll still remain.
Right.
But yeah, it's a good way to just kind of catch your breath.
Right. You need to give them a comfier sleep, basically.
You do. No sleeping in a tent.
Yeah.
So one of the critical elements of the combat system is that you now have masters you can train with. They're kind of like the shamans of the previous games, but they also kind of work like Final Fantasy VI's Magicite. Mm-hmm. Where each character can train with a different master, and that will confer stat bonuses on level up. You can switch around your masters. You can only have one at a time, if I'm remembering right.
Yeah.
But
yeah, per character.
Know, yeah. So there's, I don't think there are any masters that are just like, hey, everything, every stat is going to grow. It's like, hey, do you want to specialize in magic or in speed? What do you want? Because that's what I can help you with. Strength, you know. So you have to kind of specialize, and you can switch around to vary things up and buff up areas where your characters might be falling weak. But they also teach you battle formations, which are kind of like auto-selected. How do you describe formations?
Well, basically, Breath of Fire 2 had them, but it was like limited to these four formations, and they all had very specific stats to them. Like the first two characters in the formation in line will have like a higher attack power, but there's always trade-offs to that. In 3, it's more like depending on which character is in the line. One character like in the forefront may have a higher attack power, or my go-to was always the defense line because it just raised everybody's defense regardless of what position they were in. And then you can unlock a few more formations through one of the masters in the game.
And of course, probably the most important trademark element of combat is Ryu's ability to transform into a dragon, which is very, very like intricate in this game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you have basically a matrix of transformations activated by acquiring different genes throughout the game, dragon genes, and there's a whole lot to keep in mind when you transform into a dragon. It's not something you can just like say, yeah, I'm gonna be a dragon now and win every fight. It's kind of not a limited resource, but it's very expensive.
It is
in terms
of
ability points. And transforming into dragons can make Ryu very powerful in certain circumstances. It's not always like an instant win. If you transform into the wrong dragon type, a lot of dragon forms have elemental affinities. You can actually put yourself at a disadvantage, either in terms of like your attacks don't do anything against certain enemies, or you're super vulnerable against certain attacks. So there's a lot to factor in. And that's in addition to just the cost of transformation.
Yeah, I would say it's definitely an improvement over 2's, where in Breath of Fire 2, you use a dragon form and it saps all of Ryu's AP, and you have to work towards restoring all his AP to get the best possible hit damage from the dragon attack again. But in this one, you can transform and you can pick different forms, all shapes and sizes and whatnot, and then like commit them to memory so you can reuse them more quickly. But each turn after you, in addition to the AP cost of like him performing a dragon breath or something, it saps AP from Ryu mm-hmm. each turn. So you can't have it forever. It'll eventually sap till he has to revert back to a human form. So.
Yeah, but you have a lot of control over the dragons, which I think is a really, really cool element of the game. Like you put, if you use one dragon gene, you turn to a whelp who can still be like enough of a boost to get you through a really tough battle without like a huge sacrifice to your AP. But what's really cool is the game gives you so many transformations you're probably never going to use, but they look so amazing, like the Tiamat. Transformation Tiamat that uses all your party members, same with the Behemoth transformation. My favorite though is there's a whole bunch of dragon forms that people don't know about with the fusion gene where you fuse with one character in your party. And you get some really neat looking designs, like Momo turns into like this mechanical dragon with like a weird smokestack. My favorite though is you fuse with you can't fuse with Gar at all, which is a great little detail, but you can fuse with Rei and turn into like this tiger dragon. It's really amazing.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of promotional art of that Were-Tiger Dragon, which I thought was really neat. Yeah,
that's a nice little thing to focus on.
Yeah,
I distinctly remember using the Kaiser Dragon form in the final battle, and that still sticks with me. I feel like I mentioned this in the previous episode, but I saved up all my Hourglass powers, or the items.
Yeah.
The freeze time for everyone but the wielder, and I had like three of those when I entered the final battle. They're really scarce and I just never used them, and I got to the final battle, I was like, can I freeze the final boss? And it turns out you can. So Ryu basically got like 9 free turns as Kaiser Dragon, so that was the fight, that was it.
Yep, you can totally cheese that fight.
Annihilated God and basically like she didn't get to move. I feel I'm very sorry, God.
What's interesting about the Kaiser form is that there's a regular Kaiser form that is actually not the true one and you don't have like control of it. But then there's the true Kaiser form, which is like the ultimate form of the game. But you need a very specific gene in combination with the rest to actually create it.
Yeah, that's one thing I never understood completely. Like, I do know the Kaiser, if you use it by itself, it's like kind of a wild card that turns like uncontrollable, kind of like Rei when he's in Were-Tiger form. But that one gene, I don't know if they ever tell you you need it. I think it's the failure gene or something.
Yeah, I think it was called the failure gene, yeah.
So that's very strange, because the Kaiser was such a... First of all, it's interesting how the Kaiser looks pretty similar from game to game. That's Ryu's final dragon form, so there you go in terms of continuity.
Yeah.
I do like how, whereas it was kind of a necessity to beat Death Oven in 2 and 3, it's more like, well, if you can figure out the secret of this weird, cool-ass dragon, it's all yours. But until then, well, good luck.
So, any other comments on the gameplay and design of Breath of Fire 3 before we start moving ahead to Breath of Fire 4?
I thought it was neat that you could learn enemy skills in battle. It was sometimes a crapshoot, but there was like an examine icon that you can use and you can learn that enemy skill. And if a character learns it that you don't want them to have that skill, that's what the camp is for. You use this item called Skill Ink to transfer the skill over to another character. And that's kind of in the same line of like the skills you receive from masters as well. The other neat thing is, even though you don't create your own town per se in this game, like Township from Breath of Fire 2, this one does something in the form of like a fairy colony.
Right.
Where the player basically instructs fairies to build, research jobs, and run the place, and open shops, casinos, things like that to enhance the gameplay and whatnot.
And that's after you beat up a pink dolphin. That was a weird part of the game.
The dolphin. I wanted to mention the dolphin. There's so much humor and gags in Breath of Fire 3 that I love. There's like this mutant you have to mercy kill by like activating a conveyor belt to send him into the lava. And as that's playing, you hear like dun dun dun, like Terminator 2 or whatever.
I never noticed that. I gotta look back at that. It's hilarious.
And maybe, you know, mercy killing him is not the funny part. The funny part is you hit the wrong switch on the conveyor belt and it sends him in the other direction. And he's like, no, the other way.
I'm trying to die, for God's sake.
Yeah. And then the dolphin is this whole other thing where he's terrorizing the fairy colony and you have to take care of him. But when he comes up to Ryu, Momo, and Nina, he acts all sweet and nice in front of them. When they walk away, he changes his demeanor and starts squirting Ryu with water and starts taunting him in an Australian accent, referring to like Momo and Nina as Sheilas. And once the scene is over, the game basically in a text box goes, for those players who don't speak Australian, we have provided an English translation of the previous scene. Do you want to replay the scene? And if you hit yes, it'll replay that entire scene with the dolphin speaking in just like typical American English or whatever, which I thought this never happens like ever again in the game. It's such a random, humorous moment. But I learned that in the Japanese version, and this is just an example of like clever localization, in the Japanese version, the dolphin is, instead of speaking Australian per se, he was speaking in a Kansai dialect, which is a Japanese dialect local to Osaka, where Capcom is.
It's always Osaka.
It
always gets the crap done for its, what's her name from Azumanga, being a southerner.
Right.
Well, in fairness, Capcom is based in Osaka. So they're kind of digging at themselves.
it just feels like a lot of anime and games that I play, like not just Capcom, always like haha Osaka accent, and it's just like it's just funny to me. But I was wondering actually what he did say and what accent he was speaking in the Japanese version, and of course I was thinking it's got to be Osaka, and of course it was Osaka.
Pretty great.
All right, so this was released on PlayStation in September 97 in Japan, and in like April, May 1998 in America, then later in Europe that year. But it was reissued on PSP as one of several PS1 classics. Mm-hmm. Before the PS1 classics line, kind of remade, re-engineered for PSP that we never saw in the US because Sony CEA was like, old games, that sounds stupid. Who would want those? Yeah. We don't want the PSP to just be like a PS1 porting machine. So we missed out on a lot of stuff like this, Suikoden 1 and 2, Mega Man Legends 1 and 2. Kind of sucks. But fortunately, this version, was it the PSP game or was it the PS1 game that was released on PlayStation Network to play on Vita?
I think it's the PSP game.
PSP, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It only took 10 years later, but it happened.
Yeah, and it's a darn shame, because just to wrap up on my end, I wanted to say how this Breath of Fire 3 still has like the best sprite work I've ever seen. The only thing that comes close is Suikoden 2. And it does so much little visual storytelling, like there's a scene where Ray is trying to get from one roof to another and he slips and he just does this great thing where he does like this scattered like brained cat thing where he runs down the roof and like leaps over and he's like, oh, okay, I'll just pretend I meant to do that. And
right.
It's the one time they use this scene in the game, like these animation frames. And of course, making sprites is not a small endeavor. The fact that they took all this time to do that just for this little sight gag is fantastic. And the game's just full of things like that, like unique little touches that really tell the story of what the characters are like, especially Child Ryu and Child Nina. One really cute touch that I've noticed is that when Ryu is new to the game and fighting, he kind of screams and turns away when he waves the sword wildly. But once he meets Nina and has to start protecting her, that's when he starts to get more confidence and he like doesn't turn away and scream. He actually attacks the enemy head on.
Right. I thought that was such a nice touch.
It's very cute.
A lot of fans love to bring that up of just to show like the kind of attention to detail that the sprite work has. It's pretty great.
There's even a scene where like Momo is dealing with some adult business and Child Ninu, Ryu and Nina are fighting in the background, just kind of pushing each other around and laughing. And again, that's just one scene where you see all these unique animations and you never see them again.
Right, yeah, I think Nina, like, teases Ryu, and he starts, like, crying for a moment, like, crying animation, while, like, Momo is talking to that Repsol scientist guy about something serious. Yeah, it's pretty great.
So, Breath of Fire 3, pretty great. Now on to Breath of Fire 4, which came along about 2.5-3 years later. A pretty big gap between releases there. Was also a PlayStation game, but this was different because this was a PlayStation game that actually arrived in the US after the PlayStation 2 launch. And I guess it was slightly after the PS2 launch in Japan also, April of 2000. So, you know, it landed a little differently. I think expectations were different. And, you know, there were a lot of great RPGs released here in 2000, 2001 that kind of got short shrift because, you know, the next generation mentality took hold. Everyone was like, I've got to get my missile launching system before Saddam Hussein does and, you know, play whatever the hell was on PS2 early on. Not a whole lot, but
the bouncer.
Yes, the bouncer. Oh, yeah. That 45 minutes of delight. yes. So I feel like Breath of Fire 4 kind of was largely overlooked at the time. Certainly I overlooked it, but did the two of you overlook it?
No, but I did get it late. It came out, November in the US, and I actually didn't get it until my birthday. I always received Breath of Fire games for my birthday. That was kind of the thing. I got it in like March 2001, so a little later.
I definitely overlooked it. And to be frank, it's not a game that I've played a whole lot because I've tried. And even though I adore the graphics, I think they're fantastic, and I'd really like to get more into the game, I don't like the 360-degree turning like map. Like in Breath of Fire 3, it's hard to explain, but in Breath of Fire 3, you had limited control over your isometric view, where you could like hold down a trigger button and kind of skew things back and forth to see what you're missing behind corners. With Breath of Fire 4, you can use the shoulder buttons to turn maps all the way around and see where you're going. And that just, number one, made me feel quite motion sick. Number two, I just feel like it makes the maps feel more confined. Whereas Breath of Fire 3, okay, yes, the maps were smaller, but the way the isometric view was fixed made you realize, okay, I don't feel like I'm really confined here. But I don't know, I just can't really deal with the way Breath of Fire 4 moves, unfortunately.
Yeah, it does allow for more rotation of the camera in like four different angles. So there is a lot of like, especially in tight spots, tight villages, there is a lot of moving that around just to try to find certain NPCs, talk to them, that sort of thing. Yeah,
and that just makes me too motion sick. And it was really bad, especially in there's a dungeon that's basically a ghost town. And you have to do a lot of rotation to see where you're going and what you're doing. And I just couldn't hack it.
Right.
Yeah, that is a pretty big difference, like a node-based rotation versus free rotation. It definitely changes the experience. And I feel like the free rotation doesn't work so well when you have characters who are based on sprites as opposed to like a fully 3D thing. Like it's the difference between Final Fantasy Tactics and Final Fantasy XII. You know, like it's one of those, the sort of fixed rotation works a lot better than free rotation. I'm glad they set those up the way they did. And I get the desire to be like, no, you can freely move through this world. But yeah, it's not always great. Like the fixed approach gives it the feeling more of, you know, like the 2D games where you have kind of a predefined relationship with the world. Whereas with the full 3D, it opens things up more and just feels less guided and less focused.
Yeah, and it's a shame because I actually really adore the battle scenes. I think they look fantastic. The art's really wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, it's a big upgrade.
Yeah, you keep saying Breath of Fire 3 has the best sprite work, but man, Breath of Fire 4 looks so good. It's just beautiful. I mean, this is like Capcom at the height of their 2D sprite creating powers. This was, you know, the era of Street Fighter 3, Third Strike, and things like that. You know, JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. Just like gorgeous, gorgeous animation. And they applied that to an RPG. And it looks beautiful. And on top of that, it's paired to a really intricate story. Like there is, but this is by far the most complex lore of any Breath of Fire game, even though it still seems to kind of build on what had come before. It also feels like, you know, this world is complete and whole in and of itself, and there's a lot of history.
Yeah. Another neat thing is, going back to the sprites, is the it's more of a muted pastel sort of color to the sprites, and not as bright as
not as 3's. Bright and anime and cheerful as 3 was.
Yeah. I mean, eventually you'll come into environments that are more colorful and tropical in the game, but it starts off kind of like more drab, like you're in the desert. And I thought that was an interesting environmental shift from the previous games.
I mean, you definitely had a lot of desert to contend with in Breath of Fire 3. Kind of infamously. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
The Desert of Death or whatever it was called. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, those were some dark times. That's actually a section of the game that can kind of kill a playthrough.
I guess the unfortunate thing is that when you started out, you're given the correct directions from the guide that tells you what to do, but then he says he'll write it down for you. When you read the notes, one of the directions is incorrect. I don't know if it's intentional or not, or it could be very well a typo, but where he says to go east when talking to you, he writes down to go west in the written notes.
Maybe he hates you.
It could be that.
I've heard both ways, that it's a mistake and that also that was written that way in the Japanese. So I don't know.
Oh,
I honestly don't know.
It could be intentional, yeah.
But it's definitely like a really cruel place to have that kind of misdirection, because when you're in that desert, the longer you're out there, you can like permanently lose hit points from your max hit point tally. Like it debilitates your character. It's, you know, like playing a roguelike and encountering a vampire who, you know, drains levels or something. It's brutal. Like, don't leave me stranding it out here.
I guess I didn't struggle as much with others, but that's because I was one of those players that just stuck to the strategy guide and my eyes glued. But that is also a segment of 3 that you absolutely should probably use a guide for to save yourself.
I famously downloaded an FAQ. Not even download, sorry. I printed it because like 90s.
Yeah, so thankfully there's nothing quite like that in Breath of Fire 4. And instead, the story is... it's structured even more interestingly than Breath of Fire 3, where Breath of Fire 3 is basically like childhood Ryu, adult Ryu. This shifts perspectives, and there are parts of the game where you don't even see Ryu, which is very different for a Breath of Fire game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you have an alter ego to Ryu, Olu, and so the scenario will switch between his story and Nina's story and Olu's story. So you kind of get a glimpse of both characters' lives in a way. Pretty neat.
So do you want to talk a little bit about what Olu is and how he ties in with the story? Because I feel like, you know, this kind of, it kind of carries forward the concept of the light and the dark dragons from the original Breath of Fire, but in a more direct way, and one that, you know, has much more of a personal tie as opposed to like, you belong to a clan. Whereas this is much more like, hey, this is, you know, this is your Liquid Snake here.
If you want to bring MGS into it, sure. the interesting thing is, so from the get-go, Breath of Fire 4 is in a sense its own world. It's very different from the first, whereas you can make points to connect 1, 2, and 3 together in the same world. 4 is just, it's completely different, like its own thing. And you have a Western Empire, the faux Empire, and the Eastern Kingdoms. The interesting thing is the faux Empire is kind of modeled after like feudal China, East Asia, that kind of aesthetic, and the Eastern Kingdoms are like a mix of medieval Europe and the Middle East. Mm. And so basically the story goes that the story starts with Nina and her friend Cray, two of the main characters, and they're basically out on a sand ship looking for Nina's sister Alina, who has gone missing while she was on a diplomatic mission. Their sandfire crashes. Nina comes across Ryu, transformed from a dragon, and then they befriend each other and kind of work together to figure out what to do. And meanwhile, Fo Lu, he is basically an ancient god emperor of the Fo Empire, like from several centuries ago. After being asleep in a tomb, he reawakens and he needs to find his other half, that being Ryu, to become full and assume the throne again. And basically his goal is to reunite the continents. Of course, though, as you play through Folu's story, he sees what humanity is capable of, their terrible misdeeds, and that grows into more like, kill all humans, I hate them. That sort of thing. And to throw lots of wrenches into everything, Folu is being pursued by the current Fo Empire's General Yom, who is basically... He wants to get rid of him, in a sense. The current Fo Empire does not want their current emperor to lose his position and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So, and in the middle of that, yeah, Fo Lu wants to find Ryu. Ryu also wants to figure out what the deal is with Fo Lu and what's his purpose in the world and whatnot. But soon, like, eventually learns all, like, the dangers of Fo Lu and what he's trying to do and that sort of thing. So yeah, there's a lot of like political intrigue and that sort of thing into it. It can be a bit much to follow, but there are a lot of like incredible moments in the story in terms of like some of the awful things the Fo Empire does to be it like a town or to Ryu, like that sort of thing.
So it is quite a departure from Breath of Fire 3, which was more about humanity scrabbling from the ruins, the ashes of like past dragon wars and stuff like that, to, and they kind of make their own little societies. Like, they don't really have an overseeing empire or a king, unless you count like Wendia, which is kind of off doing its own thing.
Mm. Well, yeah. Kind of, but I mean, you know, again, I haven't really played that much of this game, but my understanding of the story is that Fo Lu, specifically like as dragon emperor, was kind of, holding his empire together and had plans to unite the entire world, but basically kind of ran out of dragon juice and had to go to sleep. Yeah, he had to do the Odin sleep and recharge for a few centuries. And so there, you know, there is the idea of the Fo Lu Empire as kind of the great unifying force, but without Fo Lu's influence, it's kind of fallen into disarray and infighting. And, you know, the fact that the empire looks at the risen Fo Lu, like their leader, their founder, the guy that they named the empire for, and they're like, yeah, we could do without him.
Yeah, basically.
We're doing fine without you, thanks.
So they're the ones who actually want to kill God in this one, in a sense. But then to throw another wrench into everything, you have this character, Lord Yuna, this occultist who is fascinated with like experimenting and basically manufacturing gods and that sort of thing, and he has his own nefarious purposes for what he wants to do to like Ryu and Fo Lu. And you also find out you know, the fate of Alina under him, which is like a very gut-wrenching moment in the game. So yeah, there's a lot of things at play here. Fo Lu, in his journeys, you see he actually befriends a human, a farmer girl, Mommy, who cares for him after he's like chased and injured by the Fo Empire. And that's where like Fo Lu even shows like a bit of vulnerability of like actually maybe thinking, oh, not all humans are that bad. but then of course, you know, the farmer girl helps him escape, and then she's basically punished by being sacrificed for this weapon of mass destruction that the Fo Empire is creating, a carronade. It's like this giant cannon that uses human souls basically to power or whatever. And so he sees that happen, of her being sacrificed to attack him essentially. And that that basically causes him to snap.
Humans suck again.
Yep. Nope. Humans suck.
I rescind my previous position.
Exactly. And so, and then the story kind of takes the shape of, okay, Ryu, Krei, Nina, their robot armor, Urshin, Sias, and Ursula, they all team up together to put a stop to this, essentially.
So this game makes some, I would say, some pretty significant changes. While it still is like unquestionably a Breath of Fire game, the way a lot of the elements play out really feels like Capcom was trying to sort of, you know, modernize the design of it. And in some ways, kind of move toward the RPGs you would see like during the PS2 era, the PS3 era, where, you know, you have like a simplified overworld and things like that. You know, that would enter the Final Fantasy series with Final Fantasy X, really, where it's just like, yeah, no overworld map anymore. It's just kind of an adventure.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting that the world map is a lot simpler. It's like dashed lines on a on a map connecting you between points and that sort of thing. So perhaps not as in-depth as 3's. It does do a few like interesting enhancements to like the some of the systems carried over from 3, like I know combat-wise, so you still have your random encounters, and even though in 3 combat took place in the same field, there was no screen transition. 4 kind of goes back to 1 and 2's way of like screen transition, and you're in like a battle screen essentially, but while still retaining the field sprites. But I think what I really liked about 4's combat was the fact that you may have only had 3 people in a main party, but you could switch out willy-nilly at any point. You had your back row and your front row, back row being the passive characters, front row being the combatants, and you can switch them out at any turn.
And switching is a free action, right?
It's a free action, yeah. So you can switch someone in and attack, yeah.
Final Fantasy X would do this like a year later.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I always thought
Square
that was interesting.
Square Enix, just or Squaresoft, I guess, just totally ripping off Breath of Fire.
Well, if you want to go even further, Breath of Fire 1 allowed you to switch characters out mid-battle. It
that was published by Square.
Yeah, there
so.
You go.
Oh, snap. But it didn't have as much nuance as it had here. Yeah, and on top of that, they implemented this combo system where essentially you could tie skills and magic together to create these like enhanced overpowered spells and basically build up a combo meter, so you could try to like build up like a 15 hit or 20 hit combo, that sort of thing, simply by like starting off with like a wind spell by Nina, then Ryu initiates a burn spell which combines to create like this wind fire combo and whatnot. So it was interesting to see how they went about like changing about combat or making it a little more exciting, that sort of thing.
Right. And they totally dropped the dragon gene concept, right?
Yeah.
There are genes, but they're not for creating new dragon forms. They're more for like summoning dragons. So when Ryu goes into his dragon form, he's still a humanoid. He's just like a bit more powerful. And then from there, you can choose either dragon attacks, which are like a cutscene of him turning into a dragon, or you can summon a dragon god, which is similar to like a Final Fantasy summon sort of attack. So yeah, it's all more like based on the animations, and you're not like an active full-on dragon during a turn.
But what I was saying earlier about how Breath of Fire 4 moves more toward the sort of modern contemporary style, I guess, of RPGs, you have animations in combat when you do summons, which is a big step away from what had come before.
Yeah, and a lot of things are modeled in 3D as well.
Yeah.
Some of the bosses are 3D, and the dragons themselves are also 3D modeled as opposed to 2D sprites.
I think that's why I earlier considered Breath of Fire 3 like the best looking sprite game, because like I always thought that Breath of Fire 4 used a lot more polygons. It still has great sprites, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, it was like the occasional boss and a whole bunch of dragons that used the 3D models, which kind of clashed with the 2D sprites.
Style of it, yeah.
With that said, though, yeah, there are a lot of unique like 2D NPC sprites and whatnot, and so on. And, another thing 4 does a lot of is a lot more mini games than 3. You have like your digging mini games. You even can go on a sand flyer at one point, and it turns into like a 3D racing game almost on like the sand dunes.
But how's the fishing? That's what I want to know. So
the fishing, it still has like the tech system from 3, but it's a bit more, you have a bit more control where you cast your line. So you go into a fishing area, and it can be a pond, a lake, or an ocean, and you basically go up to that body of water and you cast your line, or you can turn around and cast it into the other lake behind you, that sort of thing. But well, something I've never been able to try yet, because I haven't gotten my hands on it, is it actually has fishing controller support, which, which I guess I'm assuming that controller only works on like native PS1, not so much PS2 or 3 or anything like that.
I would think
that
it would work on PS2. That would have compatibility with PS1 controllers.
You might be right, yeah. But that's something I've never tried, and I really want to. That's like
me too.
Bucket list item for Breath of Fire 4. It also had the fairy colony brought over from 3 as well, with a few enhancements here and there. So, yeah. But lots of the systems from 3 basically brought over and just kind of improved upon, upgraded.
So, before we move on to the mailbag and move through that really quickly, any final thoughts on Breath of Fire 4? I don't mean to give it short shrift, but a lot of it is, you know, kind of elements carried over from Breath of Fire 3. And, you know, so we've kind of covered the bases with Breath of Fire 3.
Maybe a few things on the characters. Urshan is probably one of my favorites in this game. She's known as Master in Japan, but she's basically a sentient mechanical robot armor that she refers to herself in the third person in dialogue. She's very kooky. She laughs at inappropriate times, like in moments where the party almost gets devoured by a monster, she starts laughing. She also has a rocket punch in battle, which is pretty unique for Breath of Fire. And she's just super, super silly and weird and kind of a very endearing part of the game. And it turns out that she harbors the spirit of Dees, also known as Blue from the previous games. And so there's a connection there in that she basically harbors her spirit, and she's been summoned into this world to like guide Ryu on his quest. That sort of thing.
That explains a lot. She would laugh at like a monster about to devour the
right
body.
So the interesting thing is, even though Dees is within Urshan, Urshan is still somehow sentient and separate from Dees. So like they may be in the same like body, but their thoughts are also different in certain ways.
Huh.
It's kind of an interesting split personality that they share. And I guess another fun facet of the game is Sias. He's this lanky grass runner swords dog.
He's so cool. Holy crap.
Super cool. This like bright green robe, long katana, and what's interesting is in the Japanese version he basically slurs all his speech because he's drunk all the time.
Yeah,
so he's a drunk swordsman. He's that style, but who's also a dog. But in the Western version this was changed to, he wasn't actually drunk in the Western version, he was just a stutterer. This awkward stuttering person, which I thought was an interesting change.
Interesting touch, I guess. But I guess even then he couldn't have like perpetually drunk characters without courting controversy.
It could be that, yeah.
Just a quick question for you, because you would know this. Was Momo a grass runner?
I think so. I think most fans would assume that Momo's a grass runner.
Because I thought I read somewhere that, like, yeah, the male grass runners look like that particular the dog who you just mentioned. I can't remember his name off the top of my head.
Yeah.
And the females, of course, look a little more human. So
yeah, Momo's like animal type is hard to. I know Jeremy referred to her as like a mole-ish kind of thing, but I don't even know how, like, what the accurate animal comparison would be.
Yeah, I just went with Momo. Mole because her name is Momo, which you see with mole characters in Japanese media sometimes.
Right. What's funny is Momo is actually in Breath of Fire 4, albeit as a like a cameo master. And when you talk to her, she mentions as if she had warped there from another dimension, further fueling the idea of like this is totally a separate world from the world of the previous games.
Interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. And, yeah, because just the previous games, even though the link could be kind of tenuous, they never really broke out the hey, this is a whole other dimension thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess my final comment on 4 is just the music. It does return to like the orchestral styles of 1 and 2, but interestingly, Yoshino Aoki, who returned from 3, incorporated like Middle Eastern and Asian folk music. So like you hear a lot of like sitar and didgeridoo kind of style stuff. Even one of the boss themes is basically like sitar meets breakbeat, which is like a very 2000 thing to do.
That is.
Even thinking like Dino Crisis 2 had a lot of breakbeat going on and it came out the same year. So I thought that was an interesting touch. And basically Aoki, like when composing the music, she reflected the styles of like the faux empire, you know, having that Asian influence and the Eastern kingdoms being like a mix of medieval Europe and the Middle East. So you hear a lot of like the brass and the violins, but also sitar and that sort of thing. And I really like that. You know, it may not be the jazzy pop of 3. I mean, that's 3's wheelhouse. But 4 also, even though it returns to the orchestral form, it still does something new and unique with it. So,
all right. So with that said, let's make a quick journey through these letters. I don't think we can do all of them. There's a lot. We get letters, handwritten letters in the mail. We're going to read them to you now. Alex Reed says, Breath of Fire 4 is one of my favorite games ever, certainly my favorite PS1 RPG. I recently revisited it as an adult, and I was struck by the aesthetic cohesiveness of the whole thing. It's got to be one of the nicest looking RPGs to use that three-quarter perspective 2D sprites on 3D background look. The character sprites are detailed and beautifully animated, while the backgrounds do a wonderful job of turning the PS1's shivery polygons into a dense, believable world. Breath of Fire 4 drops you into its world and leaves you to figure things out for yourself. The setting clearly had a lot of thought put into it, but Capcom are happy to let you find out about it at your own pace. It's a breath of fresh air in a genre that nowadays is a bit too fond of drowning you in a torrent of lore. That's a good point. Yes, I agree.
I like the breath of fresh air. That's very appropriate for this episode. Thank you for inserting that.
Yes.
Brian Root says, I think both of these hold up better than most PS1 JRPGs. I don't think I can choose which one I like better, as they each do different things better than the other. Both have great fishing minigames, but I think 4 does it best with its improved mechanics and diverse fishing locations. Both have good soundtracks, but for completely different reasons. I think 3's overarching mystery about the extinction of the dragons is better than Ryu's journey in 4, but Folu's story is fantastic. And of course, 3's dragon gene system is wonderful and inventive, especially compared to the lackluster of transformations in 4. However, 4's party switching combo-making battle system is better than 3's regular combat. I highly recommend that JRPG fans check out both games on PSP or Vita. That is correct. You can download them. Mm-hmm. You can download Breath of Fire 4 as a PS1 classic.
Yeah, so it'll work on PS3 as well.
All right, a long one from Jay Thompson. Breath of Fire 3 was one of my first rentals as a very late PS1 owner, and while it didn't look as pretty as some of the RPGs I was playing on the system, it blew me away for how complex it was. A lot of people focus on the Dragon Gene system, but what actually ended up hooking me was the Master Student system where your character studied under NPCs to learn abilities based on completing certain tasks. Parts of this mechanic have actually stuck with me to this very day. One early master requires that you have a certain amount of weapons to start studying her. As a kid, I just instinctively sold off stuff I no longer used to make money, so I had to skip by this essential master. Ever since then, I've instinctively hoarded equipment to always make sure that I was prepared for situations like that. It took me a while to beat 3 via frequently restarting it after numerous rentals and eventually just buying it, and I don't think I loved it in the end, but it was a satisfying experience.
I think they're referring to DeLonzo, the master in 3, which the earliest tip I can give you in starting Breath of Fire 3, after you torch Gary and Mogu in the beginning, check their burnt corpses because they have a melted blade item, and that goes towards your count for DeLonzo, requiring you to have like 15 weapons before she teaches you anything.
I've never studied under her because I never have the weapons. I always forget. I always sell them off.
She was important in that. I think you could learn steel from her eventually, which was great when Ray was not Ray's with gone. You with his pilfer skill and whatnot. But she also raised the accuracy of the character under her. So it was ideal for Momo to be under DeLonzo because Momo can't hit anything for
Momo can't hit the bottom side of a barn. Even with like, she has like an accessory you can put on her and it doesn't help very much.
Yeah, the Artemis cap, and she still misses.
She still sucks.
I think it has to be a gag. Like, you know, she's very absent-minded and that sort of thing. So maybe it fits in with her character, but that bazooka may look awesome, but it also misses a lot.
Yeah, and it's very handy because you can change out the chrism for elemental chrisms.
That's right.
Great, but it misses. I have to say one thing about Breath of Fire 3 is so many of his dungeons are a slog, and Momo's Tower is the worst one by far.
There's a lot of tricky puzzles in that one.
The puzzles, and there's things like, oh, push this block, but the is not like a great, really hard to explain. Like, it doesn't really lock on very well. Like, things feel very random when you push them, very loose.
Yeah, I definitely needed guides for the puzzles in 3.
I said, game FAQ, print, yep, there goes my laser.
Well, I had my Prima guide, which...
perfect.
I feel like most people who had the Prima Breath of Fire 3 strategy guide, it had a very weak binding to it, so it would just fall apart. I have one that's just like pages. It's not even... to call it even a book right now, it's hard to say.
Just a folder full of pages there.
Basically, yeah.
All right, we're actually kind of running low on time, so there's a lot of letters. I'm going to put the rest of these away for a future mailbag episode. There were a lot of letters, like a lot of letters.
Yeah.
And I don't want to do everyone who wrote in a disservice. So please look forward to a mailbag episode sometime down the road. But thank you, everyone who wrote in. Clearly a lot of opinions, mostly positive, some negative, about Breath of Fire 3 and 4. So clearly games that really landed with people. And I think that kind of gets to its time and place where, you know, it was just after Final Fantasy VII. A lot of people were like, role-playing games, menu-based combat, this is very interesting and different. And they were very open and receptive to the style of game, and you know, a lot of people who were pretty young at the time, so very sort of these, you know, influential, meaningful experiences, formative, I would say. So good on Capcom for striking at developing minds and preying on those formative children. Yes, that's exactly what it is. It's predatory. Anyway. That, I think, wraps it up for our conversation about Breath of Fire 3 and 4. Someday, we will probably tackle Dragon Quarter, but I would like to play more of that game before we do that episode, because it's really cool, and I've just never had time to really sit down with it, but every time I have messed with it, I'm just like, I am so into this, and then life happens, and I don't get to play the rest.
It was definitely ahead of its time, so I really want to give it another try before I go making any judgments on it.
Please do. It's one of those games that I... at first I couldn't get into, and then I gave it a fair shake the second time around and I fell in love with it. So,
all right. I promise that we will cover that game before civilization collapses due to insurrection or climate change or pandemic. That is my guarantee to you. We will talk about Dragon Quarter before our world experiences a Dragon Quarter style apocalypse.
All right. We all move underground.
Yes.
Or Myria conjures the desert.
It's happening.
It's already happening.
All right. So that's it for this episode. If you enjoyed listening to us talk about Breath of Fire 3 and 4, you would probably enjoy listening to us talk about other old video games. And the good news is that Retronauts creates a lot of podcasts every month about old video games. You can find them at retronauts.com, on various podcatchers, at the Greenlit Podcast Network. And you can also support the show and get early access to each episode, each Monday episode, by supporting and pledging for the show. Yes, at patreon.com/retronauts. $3 a month gets you early access to every Monday episode at a higher bitrate quality than on the public feed and no advertisements or cross promotions. But if you want to throw in a couple of extra bucks each month, you also get patron exclusive episodes every other Friday. You get access to our patron Discord, where lots of cool conversations about old video games happen. I post there sometimes, you know, try to check in once a day or so. And also every weekend, there's a This Week in Retro column and mini podcast by Diamond Fight. So that's a lot of extra content for the $5 patron level. I'm not saying that you should do that, but I actually am. Yes, you should do that. All right. So, Patrick, where can we find you on the internet? Not speaking for your employer, having personal independent opinions that do not represent a corporation's interest.
So I have a few things I could plug here. Well, on Twitter, I'm at Patrick K-U-L, Patrick Cool. On YouTube, I am known as VG Drum, where I do drum covers of video game tunes. And on that game music note, I've been a regular member of my buddy Brett Elston's VG Empire podcast celebrating game music.
Cool.
We actually had a Breath of Fire episode way back in 2014 before I even joined Capcom, so check that one out. And I wanted to give a special shout out to my friend Liv Knott, who she spearheads the Breath of Fire fan community pages on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube, which are things that I started like a decade ago or so. And I guess my final plug is the Breath of Fire 1 to 5 soundtracks are actually on Steam since last summer, so go get those.
All right. And Nadia.
I can be found on the Axe of the Blood God RPG podcast that you can support us at patreon.com/bloodgodpod. And we have a free episode that goes out every week, but it's a week behind our regular episodes. And if you subscribe at the $5 level, you can get the basically the episodes when they come out ad-free. Subscribe at the $10 level for special podcasts. Like, for example, we just wrapped up a Pantheon of the Blood God podcast about Shin Megami Tensei 3 Nocturne and talked about like whether or not it deserves to be regarded as the best of the best in the genre. And I will not tell you what we said because I think you should support us and find out for yourself. And we also talk about Lord of the Rings and how that affects the how that's affected RPG development and storytelling in the past several years. We reviewed the Witcher series on Netflix. So yeah, we have a whole bunch of stuff going on, and we would really, really love it if you support us. And we also have a cool Discord that's full of a lot of Final Fantasy 14 nerds. So come on home.
Nice.
All right. And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on Twitter as GameSpite. You can find me doing stuff at Limited Run Games. This podcast does not express any opinions related to Limited Run Games. I am also independent of my employer, but I do write a lot of stuff there. So there's a pretty good chance that if you buy one of our CEs, you're going to open it up. And there's a book that I put together. And of course, you know, I've got my video series, NES Works, etc. on YouTube. Just look up Jeremy Parrish on the internet, 1R in Parrish. You'll probably find a lot of stuff. Hopefully nothing bad. Anyway, that wraps it up for Breath of Fire. So hopefully you didn't feel like this podcast was dragging.
Hey.